Where we're at right now. We're about halfway between two major interventions that LaRouche has been consistently making in Washington, D.C. About a month ago, less than a month ago, LaRouche was in Washington, and we had about 100 young people there for an entire week of action organizing. He gave a big public speech. Ed was mentioning some of it. And then in less than a month from now, another one of those is going to happen. So we're sort of halfway in between these things. And the way we mobilize, the way we operate in terms of our operations in the United States is on that kind of timetable. You say, look, we have to pull together the relevant people to come together in Washington, D.C. and discuss the question of what intervention we have to make. We sit down with the Congress. We tell them what's on the table. We bring in the union leadership. We bring in the state and local elected officials. They meet with LaRouche. The LaRouche youth movement's there in one place. And from the standpoint of what happens, what comes out of these webcasts that LaRouche gives, he says, okay, look, this is what we have to move now. Between the time that we leave Washington and the time we come back, this is what we have to accomplish. That's how we've created the entire mobilization around this question of retooling the auto sector, all those sorts of things. So we're halfway in between these things now. And I think we have to think from the standpoint here of orienting towards that kind of thing that happens in Washington. I know in less than a month in Canada, there's going to be a LaRouche Youth Movement cadre school. It's going to be held a little bit south of here. And everybody's invited to come. That's an entire weekend of work. Ed and I, maybe some other people from Boston are going to come back up here. We're going to be here for that. And then right out of that, we want to pull people into the United States, into Washington, D.C. for the major week of action we're having. I think it's the third week of...
21st of July.
21st of July, the third week of July. So that's the kind of timetable we're facing. I'll just point out that, like, one of the important things about a political briefing, if you're coming out organizing with us on the streets, you have to give people a sense of... I'll give an example. Right before this previous webcast that LaRouche gave, we launched an operation in our national center, national headquarters outside of Washington, which LaRouche dubbed the War Room. We're gonna figure out how to bring the operations that we have all around the United States. I mean, we have major organizing locals. Some of these guys from fresh from the boat, coming from California, coming from Seattle, coming from all around the United States. We have major organizing operations all around the United States, up and down the West Coast, East Coast, Boston, Detroit, the Midwest, Texas, here in Montreal, in Mexico City. So we've got North America covered. But LaRouche realized that if we were going to ram through the kind of emergency mobilization that was necessary before this system collapses, we were going to have to coordinate all of this thing. And we launched a war room operation, bringing one person in from each one of these key locals around the United States and also with contact here in Canada and in Mexico City to say, minute to minute, we're going to be figuring out the sort of terrain, the kind of territory, what the battlefield looks like. We're going to figure out where our allies are at, where we have to push next, what kind of responses we're getting from the population. We're going to crossfire that stuff into the Congress. The responses that we get in the Congress, we're going to crossfire that back into the population. And that kind of operation has made what was a broad-reaching kind of youth movement and organizing campaign into a completely focused organizing force around this emergency resolution to save the auto sector. So that's got to be central to any political briefing. And not just because, hey, it's us and we got to tell people what we're doing. But in fact, the whole world political situation shapes itself around what we do with this war room operation in North America with the LaRouche Youth Movement. And I'll give an example of how this kind of thing works. Just as an example, what Ed mentioned coming out of this April 20th, April 27th webcast that LaRouche gave, where he made a major forecast, where he said, look, we're moving into the summer of 2006, and by the time that the summer of 2006 is over, this whole financial system is going to be over. There's nothing within the current framework of the political situation that's going to ensure that this financial system could possibly survive. It's unsustainable. And he made that forecast, and nobody disagreed. The financial system, it's known. It's not a secret that this financial system is going to collapse. The major financial press around the world has been, the front pages have been covered. I mean, he mentioned the Globe and Mail. You look at the Wall Street Journal. It's on the front pages that the real estate bubble is about to pop. Earlier this week, the Wall Street Journal had a huge article across the front. They might as well have been quoting Lyndon LaRouche. LaRouche is saying, look, Loudoun County, Virginia, that's where I'm from, Northern Virginia, right outside of Washington, is ground zero for the blowout of the world financial system because of this real estate bubble. It's insane what's going on in Loudoun County. When I graduated from high school, I left like 5 years ago, and Loudoun County had houses that were being sold for maybe $100,000, $150,000. I went back to visit after 4 years, and you've got the very same houses on the market for $900,000. Some are up above $1 million. So that's like what kind of percentage? That's hyperinflation. That's the center of the entire real estate bubble, and nobody can pay it. So the Wall Street Journal earlier this week says, look, even in Loudoun County, the real estate bubble is about to pop. So nobody disagrees with the fact that LaRouche is absolutely right that this whole financial system is falling apart. The question is, in what direction does the United States orient itself? And that's what the world is watching. At the time that LaRouche made this forecast, it was very clear what he was proposing. I mean, you have to take a look at this financial system. You say, the financial system for the past 35 years has been infested with a disease, the disease of baby boomerism. Baby boomers, especially, well, you have a major counterculture here in Montreal, so there's no exception. Baby boomers in 1968 all made a mass pilgrimage to Woodstock, and they discovered the principle of instant gratification. And ever since Woodstock, I mean, you got these hippies. Look, these guys clean themselves up. They had to put on their suits if they were going to go to Wall Street. But it's still the same principle. It's instant gratification. You've got a financial system which is based on day trading and a short-term speculative orgy. Things are traded back and forth every millisecond. There's no idea of an investment in something in order to increase its wealth-making ability. The idea is, how can I get a buck? How can I get a buck? So that's the overall ideology of this financial system. LaRouche was very clear. He said, look, there's nothing within the rules of the game coming from Ben Bernanke or any of Alan Greenspan's ghosts or something like that in the Federal Reserve that's going to save this thing. You can't raise interest rates, because if you raise interest rates, everybody knows that the housing bubble will blow out. You can't lower interest rates, because if you lower interest rates, everybody knows that the hyperinflation that's already happening in the price of raw commodities is going to go through the ceiling, and that's going to blow out anything that's still functioning in the physical economy. You can't get your food to the stores if you have a trucking economy, and gas is going at like $1,800 a barrel or something like that. You take the rates of inflation that they have now, that are just the current rates of inflation, you project these things to just the end of this year, and the prices of these things are through the ceiling. This is worse than what happened, perspectively worse than what happened in Germany in 1923, in the Weimar hyperinflation. So that's clear. But LaRouche says, look, so you're not going to just play some game with interest rates or something like that. You have to completely change the nature of the system. And we have to bring back the idea of, the idea that that what makes us different from animals is that we have some sense of the well-being of future generations. And what's that?
To reason,
exactly. And instant gratification is what happens when your reason falls asleep. So if you think from the standpoint of saying, look, we have to cure this disease of baby boomerism. We have to figure out how we're going to make sure that it's some sort of, you know, they picked up all kinds of STDs when they went to Woodstock. This is one that can be cured, but not with antibiotics. It's got to be cured from the standpoint of a cultural paradigm shift. We have to change the way that people think in this culture. Back to the idea where you have to have an economic system where the primary question is, how are we going to make sure that that our grandchildren's generation or whoever's around 50 years from now has a standard of living which is better than ours and where we can sustain a growing population? That's the way you have to think. You have to think about the world from the standpoint of what it's going to be like after you die.
Sure.
And when baby boomers think about that, they say, don't tell me that I'm going to die. don't talk about the future. That makes me think that, oh, shit, I might die.
They've created a mess, basically.
What's that?
They've created a mess, basically.
Yeah, right. So the question is, okay, we've got to bring sanity back into this thing. You've got an hysterical kind of culture where people run around hysterically talking about this and that and this and that. But the question of political leadership, what Ed said, is what we have to really fight about. We can't agree to disagree with people. People actually appreciate it when you're there to be a voice of reason when they're surrounded by just a sea of hysteria.
But most people, they don't want to change.
Right.
They're afraid of change.
Well, are people afraid of change or people are not afraid of what, people get very inspired when you talk about what could be, right? But what do you think?
I don't think it's afraid of change per se, but just people are comfortable with everything being mundane, predictable, and expectable.
Sure.
You know how everything's gonna happen, and it's nice and simple and predictable.
Mm-hmm.
What actually scares people is a concept that they don't know what's gonna happen.
The fear of the unknown.
Yeah, right.
Because if you tell people everything's just going to change and still be predictable, no one cares.
Mm-hmm. That's not a new problem either. Shakespeare diagnosed that problem. We have a very large Hamlet problem in our culture today. The undiscovered country. Yeah, sure, that's right. But that's why people need leadership. That's why what the Democratic Party is doing right now, trying to cater to every single little single issue that people run around talking about. That's why what the Democratic Party is doing right now is going to lead to the destruction of civilization. Because for the very reason that you said, you can only get to the undiscovered country if you have sufficient leadership. And that's a political question. That's the question that we're dealing with the youth movement. Yeah.
But what kind of leadership? I mean, in the present system, the leaders are not intelligent. They don't have any self-knowledge, right? Like LaRouche rightly points out, it's a moral crisis. It's a moral crisis, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, leaders who haven't understood themselves. I think that the whole thing is connected, you know, in a way that it's not, I go with you that it's a political and economical crisis, but also it's a crisis of the mind, you know, not realizing its full potential, you know, a mind that is fragmented. You know, and so all its solutions are fragmented. They're not whole. Like you said, they don't really look like 100 years from now. It's just for the moment, like an instant gratification.
Right, right. Well, okay, so the question is, I mean, we are the children of the baby boomers. And we have not been provided with, I mean, the cultural connection that we have. Luckily, we still have some connection to what was the World War II generation or the Franklin Roosevelt generation. But in general, the culture that we have and the education system that we come from is actually based on and reinforcing that way of thinking. Like, for example, this is an important question of what we're dealing with the curriculum of our youth movement, the educational curriculum. How many people go through life, grow up, and are told that, look, either you're a science guy and you got to walk around with, like, you know,
calculators
in your pocket and, you know, a pocket protector and things like that, and you're antisocial and this kind of thing, you're a science guy, or, man, you're totally an artist, oh man, let your hair down, but you got like, you know, when they take the cows on their way to go to the butcher, they separate them into two different corrals. They say, you guys go this way, you guys go this way. So you have an educational system which is based on reinforcing that kind of thinking. So, I mean, the question, okay, so if that's the root of the political crisis, if that's the root of the economic crisis.
Like you say, like it has to begin with education, like because we were an educated well, right? Like in the real sense. So I think that it has to begin with education, like educating the future generations, like, you know, giving them the chance for their creative potential. You know, I think everybody, every individual has an immense creative potential. And the system that is there right now, it doesn't really give any importance to that. Like you said, it just wants you to become a machine, right? To earn mm-hmm. your livelihood. Mm-hmm. And you're a scientist and you're a mathematician and, you know, like, you want to fragment everything. Mm-hmm.
It's a consumer education yeah. system. It teaches you just to be a good capitalist consumer and just to find your place within the system and accept it. Not to be skeptical, question things.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the important question. That's why people respond to LaRouche. That's why young people respond to LaRouche.
I think he's quite unique.
Right. And now that's if you really want to get at the root of what's driving politics around the world, not just in the United States, but around the world, that's the place to get to. Why is it that you have a generation of young people, which otherwise is being bombarded with an insane culture, and is being given absolutely no access to any real hope for a future? Why is it that from within that generation, you have young people all over the planet that are responding to the way that LaRouche addresses these kinds of questions, and not just from the standpoint of oh, he said my political slogan. You're right, I like FDR also. That's important. But also from the standpoint of the fact that you have somebody who represents a focal point of political leadership who is taking young people and addressing them from the standpoint that he takes their minds very seriously. Right? And that so you have people around the world who have their eyes on that process, who are seeing that happen. It's not like we have like a million man marches through the streets or something like that. That's not the kind of visibility that you're talking about. What you're talking about is the fact that around the world, people are aware that there is this question, like in the United States, there is a strong presence of what is known as the other America, the real America. And they say, wow, this is a miracle in the process of happening. You have a group of young people, which is relatively small. It's a handful of young people, literally. But somehow, they have the potency and the capability to make huge political earthquakes. And we'll get into some of that in a couple minutes. I think it's important. I'll introduce you to a friend of mine named Keisha Rogers. I don't know how many people have heard about what she's been up to. She's been causing some trouble down in the United States, in Texas. But look, I'll just situate this question because I think that's the right kind of aspect to take this from, because that's what means that there is actually some sort of standpoint from which you can orient political discussion. In terms of, I mean, I went for 50 years, you went for 100 years in the future. That's even better. But I'll give an example. Look, at the time that LaRouche put out this forecast that I was talking about, April 27th forecast, the world was ready to respond. There were people around the world who were responding with the utmost seriousness to what LaRouche has said. I mean, don't forget that every single other public forecast, economic forecast that LaRouche has made has been right on the money. Not one of them has been proven wrong. Which we don't celebrate the fact that happened, because we would rather LaRouche's forecast be proven wrong. we don't celebrate the fact that the economic system is collapsing. But the fact is that every single one of them has been valid. And so people know that. When LaRouche says something, whether you're his friend or you're his enemy, you say, well, this is something that we have to take consideration of. And so, I mean, LaRouche put this out, but it was in conjunction with what is the solution. LaRouche never makes an economic forecast without saying, look, this is going to happen unless the policy changes in this direction. So what LaRouche was putting out in terms of the question of, okay, we've got this sickness of this financial orgy, this speculative orgy, the immediate gratification culture. We have to go back to an idea of long-term investment from the standpoint of the raising the living standard of future generations. Say the monetary system has to be completely reorganized. We're going to take what was a failed system, and we're going to reorganize it into a system based around long-term investment, 25, 50-year investment projects. Take the credit-creating capability that the United States government has constitutionally. The United States Congress has the power, ultimate sovereign power, over the creation of credit and monetary decisions. Take that power that was given to the United States government and use it to extend long-term, low-interest rate financial investments into not just flooding the markets with money, like Alan Greenspan did. He put lots of credit in there, lots of liquidity, but it was a wall of money attitude. Said every single one of this, all the new credit that's issued has to be tied down in long-term infrastructure projects. So you know that every bit of credit that you create is going to be involved in doing something productive for the people.
Like education. Opening new schools.
Uh-huh, exactly.
But that's totally different kind of schools, like, you know, which give a chance for the new generations that are coming in, mm-hmm. which are so brilliant. The children that are coming in are so brilliant, and the old schools cannot meet their...
Well, actually, the Democratic Party runs around talking about that a lot. They have this thing that they call the innovation agenda, and they run around saying very nice sounding things about the Apollo project and graduating, you know, 20 times the number of scientists and engineers per year and increasing the schools and education grants and all this kind of stuff. But the problem is that they don't have any idea what the Apollo project was about. They don't understand that the reason that you graduated, you know, 100 times more engineers and top level scientists in 1965 was because in 1963, John F. Kennedy said, by 1969, we're going to have a man on the moon. So there was a driver program to make it necessary to have a better education program. So that's what we have to look at. What are the driver programs in the United States? What are the kinds of public infrastructure projects which represent high technology driver projects that push the envelope of what we've ever done before? Things that we consider impossible now that are going to happen because we make them happen. Things like transnational magnetically levitated rail networks, things like Ed was bringing up, solving the water crisis in southwest United States and the entire North American area there by building nuclear-powered desalination projects along the Gulf Coast and up the Pacific Coast. Projects like that. You say, put in trillions of dollars, tie it down in those projects, and you know that the money is going to flow, but you're looking at it from the standpoint of saying, not from the cult of money that says, okay, if money's flowing through the economy, if it's circulating through the economy at this rate and you can measure this statistic, then the economy's fine. No, you say this stuff is going towards productive employment. The credit that's created is going towards productive employment and is going towards the bill of materials, the manufacturing that you're going to need to build this thing. So he said, that's the question. Can the United States initiate that cultural, that paradigm shift in economic and financial policy? And then if we do that, there's very specific things that we're going to do to carry that about. We can get into that more in discussion. This whole Emergency Economic Recovery Act, the question of auto reconversion to build infrastructure, that kind of thing. But anyway, LaRouche put out that question. And all across, not just all across the United States, but all across the planet, all of a sudden, every day that went by, everybody knew we were getting closer and closer to the imminent collapse of the financial system. But also, every day that went by, more and more support was growing for LaRouche's solution. And so, all of a sudden, you had a freak out. And the question was, okay, how do we throw a monkey wrench in the works? How do we stop this process from happening? And they've got LaRouche's enemies, the people who you're looking at, have got geopolitical games that they play to try to stop this kind of process of cooperation. I'll just point out one example, which reminds us of what happened back in the 1990s when we were at a similar period. Think about what was happening around the time period of this previous spring. You had a series of provocations that were launched. Different conflicts started flaring up in different areas of the world. You remember Milosevic was murdered in The Hague. You had the potential for a flare-up of another Balkans war. You had all kinds of different tensions. There's hot spots around the planet the heat was being turned up. The Iran provocation came back on the table. But this reminds us, and it's very important to see how the world responded, of what happened, like for example, back in 1998. This is the last time that we were at a point, we're actually far beyond the level of this kind of level, but in 1998, you had the collapse of the hedge funds around the planet, the LTCM crisis, long-term capital management collapse, and people said this is potentially the domino effect of the entire world monetary system. And at that point, the leaders of the two leading powerful countries in the world, Russia and the United States, came out with their versions of LaRouche's new monetary system. President Clinton, came out in 1998 and called for a new financial architecture. He was making a speech in New York, and he called for a new financial architecture, which was in discussion based on the question of LaRouche's call for a new Bretton Woods system. And then simultaneously, you had the Prime Minister of Russia, Primakov, calling for a similar kind of thing. Change the currency system, change the monetary system around the world. So how do you stop that kind of thing? Go ahead.
Was Clinton actually calling for fixed exchange rates? For the dollar and that's what, do you know anything about this 98 speech?
Yeah, it came out of a huge campaign that LaRouche ran at the time calling for a new Bretton Woods conference. And it was, I mean, the speech came out of direct discussion with people like Robert Rubin and those kinds of things. So it was obvious to everybody that this was LaRouche's idea of a new Bretton Woods. But look, the question of, I mean, it's just an example. What happened at that time? You had a war. You had a war in the Balkans, and you say, okay, stop any kind of potential collaboration. That's what LaRouche, so after these provocations began to happen at the beginning of this year, go ahead.
And you have the money.
What's that? And you have Monica. Everybody likes to talk about Monica. So that's what began to happen at the beginning of this year, too. You had a series of provocations that began to be launched. I mean, you had Ed said, you know, Cheney went over, forgot what country he was in, but he called for the Cold War, the sequel, or something like that. Anyway, but so LaRouche said, okay, look, get the word out. I know what's going on. We can't fall for these games. And immediately the world responded. I mean, one thing that happened, you remember, this was a pretty big question. The foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, came out and said, wrote a huge article and said, we as Russians are not going to fall for these games. And we know where it's coming from. We've been manipulated by geopolitics ever since Churchill made the speech in Missouri talking about the Iron Curtain. Ever since Franklin Roosevelt died, Russia has been manipulated in these geopolitical games run by these Anglo-Americans, and we're not going to do it anymore. We know what's going on. And the fact that he pinpointed this question of the death of Roosevelt and the speech by Winston Churchill was very important. it said something to the world that was in the subtext that didn't really need to be said openly and clearly, but it was heard loud and clear that this is Lavrov coming out and saying, look, LaRouche knows what's going on, and we're taking his advice. We're not going to fall into these games. LaRouche had just put out a pamphlet, which was our prolegomena for the Democratic Party, the Franklin Roosevelt legacy, and the entire question of the political situation.
Also, Sykes-Picot.
Right, and the Sykes-Picot question. The question of the political situation was, look, this started with the death of Roosevelt. This started with Churchill's speech. We've got this goofy-looking picture of Winston Churchill, all dressed up in his oligarchical garb in his pamphlet. So that's where it came from. And the world said, okay, look, you've got Lavrov over here playing the LaRouche card. And that was one level. Now, it got bumped up to a whole new level when Putin came out and said, in his State of the Union speech, quoted Franklin Roosevelt twice in this one speech. He quoted Franklin Roosevelt saying something like, I don't care if I have to step on some very powerful toes if I'm going to stand up to protect the general welfare of my people. And Putin said, I agree with Roosevelt. So that's exactly what, when people hear Franklin Roosevelt, they know exactly where it's coming from. So I think that, the question of what we're looking at in terms of the world orienting around what LaRouche is doing, just to bring it into focus, what's happened this week. Lavrov was the guy also that was involved in the negotiations around the IAEA in terms of trying to cool down the hot spot that Cheney was trying to play with Iran. They had the negotiations around the fuel enrichment. Instead of the world saying, Cheney is going to go for this worldwide war, there's nothing we can do about it, this is given, there's going to be a war with Iran, they said, no, we're going to intervene in this thing, because they said there is another force inside the United States. There is another question of, there is something else moving parallel with the insanity of Cheney and Bush. There's something else that's moving there. And plus, LaRouche had just spent a lot of time in Europe having a whole series of conferences in Berlin, bringing in the leadership of this entire Eurasian area. A guy named Sergei Menshikov, a very high-level guy in Russia, came. People from China, people from India, from Western and Eastern Europe were in a conference with LaRouche in Berlin at this point, where he said, look, the issue is not Iran, the issue is these geopolitical games. Look at the threat of the collapse of the financial system. There was an intervention there. Now, it was really interesting what happened. Russia and China decided to bring Iran into this organization called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO. They said, we have this alliance between Russia, China, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. We're bringing in a few nations this year to be observers to our conference, including India, but also including Iran. And all of a sudden, you had a security alliance among half of the world's population opposed to the insanity of Cheney and Bush. I mean, that's even worse than like 10% approval ratings. That's like 3 billion people. I don't know what kind of percentage that is. So that's what we're leading up to. And so this week we had the meeting of the SCO, and I just want to give you a sense of how LaRouche thinks about this. This is a short statement. I'm reading this because it was read to, how many people were listening to that radio station?
The radio station? There's a couple
in Russia.
On occasion, it gets like a million, but generally, it's a couple hundred thousand.
Right.
All the time, listens.
Major radio station called Talk Moscow, that's broadcast around Russia, got a hold of this document by LaRouche, and decided to read it, leading up into the SCO conference, and it was the editorial of our EIR magazine. It's called A Turning Point in History. Just let LaRouche speak for a little while. The onrushing collapse of the post-1971 IMF system represents one of those periods in world history when great and sudden changes in relations among nations is the most crucial and most immediate issue before all peoples and their governments. Long-term cooperation built around the Shanghai Cooperation Association is a needed building block for a new world system of economic cooperation among perfectly sovereign nation-states. The shift in world monetary financial patterns during 2006, typified by the combination of a hyperbolic acceleration of prices and commodities and an accelerating collapse in hedge funds and related interests, makes a state of affairs which confronts the world as a whole with the prospect of a threatened early collapse of the present world system comparable to what happened to the Lombard League leading up into the so-called New Dark Age of the 14th century. Only a principled change in the world's monetary financial system could halt this presently ongoing collapse. So, I'll skip some part. And then he situates the role of Russia in this. The crucial feature of such a physical economic program must be an emphasis on Russia's scientific legacy in the matter of biogeochemical development of so-called natural resources and the increasing reliance on nuclear fission and thermonuclear fusion as indispensable modalities for dealing with the soaring crisis in both fresh water and suitable primary mineral supplies for a world population, hungry for benefits of development, which now approaches 8 billion living individuals within a generation or so. The new world economy must arise quickly from the ashes of the present world monetary system. It must be organized around the conception of Eurasia's leading role in global perspective based on the same kinds of goals for the world at large. That means, in the language of the science of physical economy, first derived by Gottfried Leibniz, a policy of increase of the potential relative population density of the planet through capital-intensive modes of investment in basic economic infrastructure and the production of goods. Therefore, the development of closer ties of cooperation among the sovereign states of Europe, using Russia's natural role as a leading Eurasian nation, is the virtually self-evident political vehicle for accelerating the needed new policy orientations of the planet as a whole today. That was read in Russia. Now, what was the discussion at the SCO between China, Russia, India, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Iran, half the world's population, all of Eurasia almost, was for a Silk Road Renaissance, a revival of the idea of a Eurasian land bridge, the idea of a Eurasian development bank focused on long-term investments in development corridors, building new cities in Russia, in Western China, in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, which are these vast nations that are completely undeveloped, and an orientation around that kind of cooperation for a future perspective, 50 to 100 years. That was the kind of discussion that happened at the SCO. In the meantime, you had an article published in the Tehran Times in Iran calling for a new Bretton Woods conference. Reorganize this collapsing financial system in the image of Franklin Roosevelt's Bretton Woods. So all of a sudden, LaRouche's influence exploded to the surface in the discussion around Eurasian development. Just the day before yesterday, there was a big radio show in the same Moscow, Talk Moscow, where you had three high-level academicians from the Russian Academy of Sciences, from I think Moscow University and other places, a guy named Yuri Gromyko and others, who had a whole discussion of Dr. LaRouche's economic policies. What's the orientation of this for the future? This guy, Yuri Gromyko, said, well, I'm proud to say, I actually am in contact with Mr. LaRouche, and this is what he's talked to me about. He's very excited, right? I'm the top spokesman for Lyndon LaRouche. So that's what you're looking at. So that's Eurasia. And then you've got another phenomenon happening in South America. You've got the so-called President's Club, where led by Kirchner in Argentina, who's really had some balls to stand up against some creatures like Rohatyn. He kicked the Suez group out of Argentina, nationalized their water. Yeah, that's the Suez group. You have the same similar kinds of things happening in Bolivia. You have a whole cooperation among the so-called President's Club in South America. And they're talking about transcontinental economic integration projects around transportation, around nuclear power, around just general development projects. So here, you've got Eurasia and you've got South America ready for an economic renaissance. They're ready for it. But the problem is they are on the verge of giving up on the United States. They see the kind of gutlessness that's coming out of the so-called opposition. They say there's some sort of backroom deals being made here. We say we've got there's nothing in terms of the formal political environment in Washington that would on the surface give you some sort of confidence that look, there is a potential recovery on board in the United States. You've got people are seeing the opposition party, the Democratic Party, already sort of deciding that they've been a defeated army. It's like an army that goes into battle with the perspective that they've already lost the war. It's that kind of thing, and it's pathetic. So, and you've got these guys bending over for the kind of electoral pragmatism that goes along with taking money from Felix Rohatyn and popular opinion politics and things like that.
How can they think they're defeated with Bush's approval rate?
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
I don't
exactly.
Can you explain?
That's the question. What kind of psychosis are these guys under the spell of? There's absolutely nothing that says that you've lost some sort of war. I mean, we're in the best position that we could be in. In terms of if you were thinking from the standpoint, I mean, think about the relationship to the rest of the world. You've got people running around, oh my God, China, right? Freaking out about Democrats, freaking out about China, you know, Republicans freaking out about Iran. Why are you worried? These countries are involved in a huge international cooperation around talking about economic renaissances. Isn't that a good thing? So there's... What are you dealing with? You're dealing with a cultural problem in the baby boomer generation. So you say, okay, why are these people insane? Well, we don't want to spend all of our time figuring out why they're insane. Let's just get in there and provide some leadership. If they're not going to lead, we're going to do it. And that's the question. That's what we're looking at. That's what the leadership of Russia, the leadership of Europe, well, the leadership of South America, people like Kirchner, and other members of the President's Club. There's something else that they're looking at beyond the formal political environment, beyond the votes that happen on the floor of the Senate and campaign speeches about ethanol and things like that. Mm. Something else that they're looking at. Where's the leadership actually coming from? Where's the other America? So I want to give you, that's why I wanted to tell you that because I wanted to make sure that you know why a political briefing is not sufficient unless you start it with the question of the LaRouche Youth Movement's war room operation and our North American mobilization. The war room is the central point of any kind of political orientation. That's what the world is keying off of. So look, let me give you a glimpse of this. Question of the operations that are happening around the United States. It became clear that the only thing that can save the United States, I mean, the only thing that can put the United States back into the position of being a force for good, like we were during the time of Franklin Roosevelt, where we can provide international leadership, is if we have this Emergency Recovery Act that LaRouche put forward. The question of the saving the machine tool sector, everything that Ed went over. And we launched a national mobilization around this. We had contact with every single county Democratic chairman in the United States. In the United States, we have in the states, like some states have like 100 counties. And so these are the local Democratic Party organizations. And the leaders of them are the Democratic Party county chairman. We launched a campaign to contact every single Democratic Party county chairman in the entire United States and mobilize them and use them to mobilize their constituents, their people, around ramming from a grassroots level the question of the emergency auto resolution into the United States Congress, putting the pressure from the bottom included in the kind of work that we're doing in Washington, D.C. So leading that kind of campaign led directly into a series of interventions that we did all around the country in a kind of campaign mode. This is the time of Democratic state conventions, and I can't even count how many of these things that we went to.
Like all of them.
We were in every single state in the United States. In fact, my friend Wes Irwin is in Idaho right now at the Idaho State Democratic Party Convention, I think. We went to every single state convention that was in the country. I mean, we were at the Massachusetts State Convention. We actually had delegates inside. We were at the Buffalo, New York State Convention, the Michigan Convention, the Indiana Convention, Iowa Convention, the New York Convention, the California Convention, the Washington State Convention, Oregon Convention,
Alabama.
There
was no convention.
Texas.
North Carolina Convention. Yeah, and last but definitely not least, the Texas State Democratic Party Convention. Now, all right, this was leading into the week of action that I was talking about before. What we had, where we had 100 young people in Washington, D.C., you had LaRouche's webcast, you had trade union leaders coming in from all over the country. And at the same time, we had an advertisement run in the major Capitol Hill newspaper, Roll Call newspaper, and then the next day in the other one, the Hill newspaper, an ad with the text of LaRouche's emergency resolution with 100 signatures attached, coming from trade union leaders, coming from elected officials, coming from former senators, former congressmen, the former secretary of, what was that woman under Clinton?
Surgeon General.
Yeah. So the kind of, we collected everything that we had in terms of our operations around the United States and Canada and put this, directed it into like a laser beam focus on Washington, D.C. for that week. But simultaneously, actually the same time that LaRouche was speaking in Washington, we had the Democratic Party State Convention in Texas, too. Now this was a day of celebration in Texas, because it was the day that Tom DeLay packed his bags and left Washington. Tom DeLay was the hammer. He was the George Bush's favorite son, his exterminator in Congress. And he has been indicted and is resigned from the United States Congress. But everybody knew that he was not resigning because of what the Texas State Democratic Party had done. They had said, this guy's untouchable. We can't do anything to bring this guy down. This is Tom DeLay. And a small handful of members of the LaRouche Youth Movement based out of Houston ran a campaign for 2 years bringing this guy down. And it worked. The guy was gone. And so there was no question about it, but this was a victory for the LaRouche Youth Movement. So Texas had been on fire for several weeks leading into this convention, because there was a candidate on the scene touring around the entire state talking to everybody, a young woman named Keisha Rogers, who's 29 years old, who's been a member of the LaRouche Youth Movement for the past 3 years, bringing LaRouche's economic solution to every single Democratic constituent in the state. And so the same time that LaRouche was speaking on Friday of that week during the webcast, Keisha Rogers was addressing the Texas State Democratic Party Convention. So I just want to show this clip. This is really, really inspiring.
You want to set it up?
It's she's introduced by three she's introduced by three other members of the LaRouche movement in Texas. Those are nominating speeches, and then she comes next. So
it's going to be on the screen.
Can you make it full screen?
I can make it full screen.
Yeah.
People can't see. Can come up.
Turn it up.
Turn it up. It's going to play it again.
Oh, it's going to download it again as well.
No, it's just, no, I know what's happening.
Oh.
It's learning.
Yeah, you gotta wait for it to load up, so.
It's alright, it already loaded.
And it already loaded on the small one. Mm.
Suspension.
Now it's loading this one too.
Yeah, that one blocks. I did it last week. You had to restart it now.
With the computer.
I'm serious. No, you gotta shut it down and do it again.
Just go back and then click on it again.
Can you do it on the laptop?
Is the laptop quicker?
It won't be.
You don't have to shut it down.
No, you don't have to shut the computer down. You just gotta
You gotta save the
address it.
Yeah, I'm gonna
do it. Here you go.
Alright, go ahead.
It's not gonna work on the
big
screen.
That's okay.
Just
leave it, that's fine.
Next, we have the representatives of Lakeisha Rogers. The first speaker is Natalie Lovegren, I believe.
These are all members of our movement.
For 2 minutes.
They're going to speak for Keisha.
Hello?
Go bigger.
My name is Natalie Lovegren. I'm from South Texas, Rio Grande Valley, a strong Democratic area. And I'm proud to nominate and support Keisha Rogers for the position of Texas Democratic State Chair. Keisha is here as a leader of the LaRouche Youth Movement. Now, a few of you may still be...
All right, y'all. I was run against by LaRouche here. I think every time I ran for chairman or re-election as chairman, we believe in free speech and the Democratic Party. Please don't boo, because I'll have. Because if you do, I'll have to add back time, and I don't have to do that. Thank you for your courtesy.
A few of you may still be stuck in the 80s and believe slanders about LaRouche, but some of you may remember the 1980 Democratic State Convention in San Antonio, where LaRouche addressed the convention. He was brought in by Texas farmers, and he warned that if we moved away from the FDR tradition and abandoned labor, abandoned farmers, abandoned small business, that we would become a minority party. Now, Keisha is part of building a youth movement to revive that legacy, to revive the Franklin Roosevelt legacy, and to rebuild the nation through a new mission orientation around scientific and technological development, around creating jobs through mass infrastructure projects for water, power, transportation. Keisha understands that it's the responsibility of every elected official and every representative of our republic to look to those in the greatest need and the poorest condition and fight to uplift them. Her campaign represents mass outreach and recruitment to old and new voters to revive that principle, the principle of the general welfare, principle of the common good, to revive that principle in this state. Keisha represents the dignity and the commitment to principle that is greatly needed to lead this party, and it's my honor to nominate and support her. Thank you.
And the next speaker is Michael, is it Maddie. I got close.
There are 5,000 people that's been
mentioned,
by the way.
I second Lakeisha Rogers' nomination as a member of the baby boomer generation that now is misleading the nation. Lakeisha represents not only the youth who look for real leadership from the Democratic Party. She also represents those Democrats of my generation who know the party must reject the post-industrial ideology of the 1960s that infected our generation. This ideology has led us into the pit of globalization and free trade. Right now, it is causing the shutdown of our auto industry and its essential machine tool capacity and the highly paid skilled jobs associated with it. Keisha has been an active Democrat as a grassroots organizer and precinct chair for several years. Keisha says it's time to return to the tradition of FDR and industrial production and skilled jobs and decent wages. She is calling on Democrats to get behind the program for the poor and middle class, students and the elderly, the lower 80% we have largely abandoned as Democrats. This is an organizing strategy that will bring former Democrats and disenchanted voters in general back to our party. That's how we will win in November and in 2008. Bell delegates, vote for Keisha today and follow her out of the bushes into the future.
The next speaker is Dennis Dalton.
Hello there. My name is Dennis Dalton, and I am glad to nominate Keisha Rogers for the Democratic State Chairmanship. Now, at age 18, I joined the U.S. Navy, and I did this for two reasons. First was to serve my country, but second was to gain the leadership skills necessary to be a Democratic candidate that could win and lead this nation to victory. Well, I did get elected as a Democratic candidate to the precinct chair now twice, but the leadership skills I've learned have come through organizing with the LaRouche Youth Movement, organizing on the streets of this nation, talking to the population about the necessary economic reforms that our country needs to survive. Now, we organize mostly on college campuses, organizing around the FDR tradition, industrialization, infrastructure projects. But we have battles with these students, battles over ideas that will shape this country's future. Now, Keisha and I came up, we cut our teeth in a fight we waged against Tom DeLay in the 22nd Congressional District. There was not a corner of that district, a stone left unturned, that we did not go into, whether it was door to door or on the traffic islands, we were educating the population about the evils of Tom DeLay. Now, leadership, on the other hand, though, is not just telling people how bad things are. We have to have a solution to the problems. We have to go in and demonstrate to people that there are real solutions to this crisis that we face as a nation. And Keisha Rogers has demonstrated time and time again that she's willing to fight for a real transformation against globalization and free trade. We're going to get out of the bushes and into the future with Keisha Rogers. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, to close on her own nomination, is the LaKeisha Rogers. LaKeisha.
Hello, Democrats. My name is LaKeisha Rogers, and I am running for your Democratic Party chair. I am running because this nation is in great danger. We are in danger right now of losing our nation, losing our Constitution, and losing the principles which shaped this great republic. We are losing those principles because thugs like Dick Cheney, Tom DeLay, have destroyed our country and the values in which we represent. We have to take them back. This is why I've launched a campaign with the slogan of Out of the Bushes and Into the Future. And those of you who know what that means know that we must fight now to take Texas back and take this nation back. I have fought in the Democratic Party and been a Democrat for the last 29 years. I'm 29 years old. I've served as a precinct chair for many years, and I've taken on the fight which is necessary to adopt the principles to take the country back to the ideas and the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt, to those ideas that were once shaped by great leaders such as Henry B. Gonzalez and Ralph Realbro, who understood that we had to stand up to the demise of those of Wall Street and the financier interests, those who are now trying to come in and hijack and cripple the Democratic Party, those like Felix Roten who want to destroy our party, and individuals who want to make sure that we don't have a nation any longer. I want to let you know that I have led the fight on the ground to build a groundswell in the Democratic Party, to bring the fight back to the people once again. We cannot be mechanical about this. This party is not about business, and it's about bringing in ideas from young people, bringing in ideas to shape the future once again, bringing in those ideas that are going to challenge the traditions which are necessary to have a real impact in the population, fighting for the forgotten men and women of this nation. The first order of business for the Democratic Party has to be to get Cheney out now. And Maxine Waters, representative from California, has just recognized this, and I am going with her on that one. I stood strong in the fight to bring down Tom DeLay, going door to door, organizing day by day. I want to let you know, I am an organizer. After graduating college, I found that our generation had no future. We're not trained in skilled labor. Our productive capabilities are falling. We're losing our labor forces right now. We have to bring labor into the discussions of a Democratic Party. We have to bring the forgotten men and women. Why is it that we have almost 36 counties here not represented? We should have made sure that they were here. Why is it that we don't have more young people here? I'm going to bring them in. Why are we not addressing the needs of our farmers? We have to bring them in now. And I ask you today that you join me. I am ready to join with you as your leader and as a candidate for the Texas Democratic Party chair. I'm ready to work with you to reorganize and change this party back to the traditions which it once represented. I know I'm young. I don't know everything. But you and I together will take this party back, we'll take it back to the people, and we'll make sure that we win the fight to take Texas back out of the bushes and into the future, and we are going to do it without delay. Democrats, I'm counting on you to make a change. Join me now. Thank you.
Awesome.
Yeah,
on the other side.
Yeah, okay, so look, that's just to finish it up here, and then we should open it up for discussion. What Natalie said, the first nominating speaker, what she said is exactly right on the mark. LaRouche spoke in San Antonio at the Democratic Convention in 1980, and he said, look, the Democratic Party will become a minority party and an impotent political force in this country unless we return to the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt. And that was the time at which the Democratic Party had gone with Brzezinski, Carter, anti-technology, anti-nuclear, and that's exactly what's happened. So, Why are we a powerful political force? Because we represent that tradition, the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt, and we're bringing it out to the people. See, the thing that our secret weapon is the reason why we can defeat Felix Rohatyn. It's not like we're gonna you know, open up our own financial cartel and like make more money than Felix Rohatyn and buy back all the Democrats from Rohatyn or something like that. His method of politics is invalid. Our method of politics works, and the only reason why Rohatyn's been able to take control is because the Democratic Party forgot about the people, forgot about the lower 80%. So that's why we're there. We're organizing, and there's absolutely that's territory which is untouchable to Felix Rohatyn. So the fight is, in the eyes of the world, between the United between LaRouche and the what LaRouche calls the international synarchist force that Rohatyn represents. And people have got their eyes trained on the LaRouche Youth Movement in the United States. So the question of the international LaRouche Youth Movement is a very interesting question, because we have to just think about this question, this thing of how do you give somebody a sense of the question of auto-retooling, not just from a programmatic standpoint, but give somebody a sense of this from a standpoint of real history and the real question of what's the actual fight around this. Felix Rohatyn drives a car. He doesn't hate cars or something like that. That's not why he's involved in the bankruptcy of Delphi. That's not why all of his friends have been for the last 20 years involved in a huge fascist financial conglomerate that's been coming in and systematically shutting down every single manufacturing capability in the United States. What Ed went through. The question is, I mean, I'll tell you something. Adolf Hitler, during World War II, said that if he wanted to destroy the United States, his number one target would be the assembly lines of Detroit. Yeah. That's the place he would bomb the first. And it's very obvious why. Before World War II, Franklin Roosevelt's strategy came out of the suggestion of a man named Walter Reuther, who was the head of the United Auto Workers. Walter Reuther put out a paper called 500 Planes a Day. He said, what we need to provide is logistical strength. We need to back up our allies in this war against Hitler and the Nazis in terms of the ability to produce technology. And the famous line out of this paper is, this battle can be won, this war will be won on the assembly lines of Detroit. So it was a miracle what they did. It was because of the creative potential of the American population, the fact that you didn't have a nation full of peasants or something like that, but that the idea of the United States had been to emphasize the creative capability of every single citizen. And that capability went to work, and we overshot our goal, more than 500 planes a day. And it was actually very ironic, because we were able to do this, even the British, who hate the fact that the American population has this kind of manufacturing capability and this creative power, that's what they had hated about the fact that we won the American Revolution, even the British were forced to ally with us, because we had that power. But after Franklin Roosevelt died, the question was, look, if we couldn't bomb Detroit from Nazi airplanes, if we couldn't destroy the economic power of the United States and the American system in that way, how are we going to do it? We're going to subvert it from the inside. And now we're facing a situation where because of the 68er phenomenon, the Woodstock baby boomer mentality, anti-technology, anti-blue collar, anti-industry, it's now become fashionable to support to be opposed to this manufacturing capability in the United States. It's now part of the culture to actually hate the fact that that industry is there. That's the baby boomer way of thinking. And they say, if you can get it out of here, if you can get those people if you can get cheap labor to do the job for us and make it cheaper for me, more power to you. And now Felix Rohatyn, coming from the same bank, Lazard Frere Bank, that funded Adolf Hitler's rise to power, is doing exactly what Hitler wanted to do, but he's doing it according to legal procedure. He's got the bombs, he's got the detonators, he's blowing up the factories of Detroit and Indiana in the process of destroying the economic power of the United States. So we've got to situate ourselves from that standpoint. What was it about America that allowed us to win World War II? What was it? What is it that is actually expressed in this totally inspiring thing about 500 planes a day? What was it that we see as radiating influence out of the circles of Benjamin Franklin or Franklin Roosevelt? It's the question of exactly what Ed addressed. Are we going to actually can we take on the question of can we take on the question of the spreading of the American system of economics and see that as the actual enemy that these guys are waging a war against? So we just want to I just want to open up a discussion. The question of why is it that a handful of young people in North America, and then also what's happening in Europe right now, we can get an on-the-ground report from Pascal, who just got back from France. Why is it that this handful of young people are so effective in posing the potential for the other America? Or we have to think more in terms of the potential for a renaissance, as opposed to what these Rohatyn and Cheney are planning out for a dark age. So I just opened up a discussion. Just say one more thing. I think the other thing that needs to be included in the political briefing is that the Montreal LaRouche Youth Movement just got done with 48 hours of some pretty intense educational work. You can see some of the fossils of it here on the board. We've been, people's voices might sound a little bit tired. I know Ed's voice is a little bit tired, and people might be have like Pythagorean triangles drawn in their arm and stuff like that. It's just because we've been immersed in 48 hours of some pretty intense work on what you could call the meat and potatoes of the LaRouche Youth Movement. We've been working on a paper by Carl Gauss, the Fundamental Theorem of Algebra. We've been working on trying to learn some of a piece of music, a choral composition written by Johann Sebastian Bach, Jesu meine Freude. So, wouldn't want to end a political briefing without people knowing about that.